solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
The other piece of that I think is important to mention is 95% of people believe that they're self-aware, and only about 10 to 15% of people actually are. And of course, that vastly oversimplifies it, but just to give you kind of the high level. And so this thought of, well, I'm self-aware, I don't really need to work on my self-awareness is kind of the default state. But then if we look externally and we look at, this has been found in almost every culture around the world, we are living in a world where we are more and more focused on ourselves while at the same time seeing ourselves less and less clearly. And you look at things like social media and reality TV and the self-esteem movement, which it turns out self-esteem actually doesn't help us be more successful. All of those things are creating an environment where we're being tempted to become more self-absorbed and less self-aware.
Welcome to the 49th Conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm an executive coach, and I engage with organizations and leaders during phases of high-stakes transitions, whether it's related to an organization or the leader's career. I feel just like companies need to be coherent about the two questions, where to play and how to win, in the context of their strategy. We all need to be clear about our responses to the two questions, where to go and how to grow. I help leaders play to their unique potential by addressing these two questions, especially during key points of transition as they go through their journeys. In this podcast series, I talk to leaders from multiple domains, CEOs, sportsmen, artists, thought leaders, on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. I should also mention at the outset that I'm excited about the lineup of podcast guests in the coming weeks. In the pipeline, we have an interesting set of guests. We have Alan Eagle, co-author of the book Trillion Dollar Coach, an insight into the methods of Bill Campbell, who's coached the who's who of Silicon Valley. We have James Clear, author of the New York Times bestseller, Atomic Habits. We have Professor Linda Grattan, a professor at London Business School, and author of the book 100 Your Life, and how we should think about staying relevant in a world where we possibly will work till our 70s and 80s. And Katia Vlachos. Katia is an expat transition coach who speaks at length about settling in well when you're on an expat assignment. Stay tuned for all this coming your way in the next few weeks. Now let's dive into the conversation at hand today. My guest today is Dr. Tasha Urich. Tasha is an organizational psychologist, researcher, and New York Times bestselling author. She helps companies from startups to the Fortune 100 succeed by improving the effectiveness of their leaders and teams. Tasha's first book, Bankable Leadership, debuted on the New York Times bestseller list in 2013. Her latest book, Insight, delves into the connection between self-awareness and success. And here she shares the surprising findings from her multi-year research program on this topic. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Tasha Urich. Tasha, thanks for making the time. Really excited to have you at the Play to Potential podcast.
The feeling is mutual. Happy to be here.
And before we dive in, I'm curious about how you got here. What got you curious about the notion of self-awareness?
I've been an organizational psychologist for a little bit more than the last 15 years or so. And I saw over and over and over these wonderful executive coaching clients I was so privileged to work with. You know, they would start out at different points in their journey. Some of them would be successful and they wanted to be more successful. Some were, on a bad day, downright delusional in terms of seeing themselves clearly. But what I saw time and time again was that the clients who had the courage and the commitment to look at themselves in a new way and say, you know, who am I really? How do other people see me? How do I fit into the world? They were able to make just transformational improvements. And if you sort of put that along the backdrop of what the world looks like today, which is in my, you know, in our research has shown that people are getting more self-absorbed in general and less self-aware. And it became clear to me, at least anecdotally, that this was a hugely important skill, not just in business, but to be a human that exists in the world today. And that was what led me down the path of researching it. I was surprised to discover when I started to look at, you know, the really hardcore scientific research that had been done, there wasn't as much out there as I thought there would be. And what our research program, which has been going on for, oh gosh, more than 5 years now, has tried to identify is, what is self-awareness? Where does it come from? Why do we need it? And probably most important, how do we get more of it?
Got it. And you call it the meta skill of the 21st century. And I was curious about, you know, why is it a meta skill, number one? And number two, why is it more relevant now than ever before?
That's a really important question. So let me just give you a snapshot of some of the improvements that people who increase their self-awareness typically see. So what we know scientifically is that people who are self-aware are more promotable. They perform better in their jobs. They're more confident. They're better communicators, better influencers, significantly better leaders. There's even some evidence that leaders or companies, rather, who are made up of a large number of self-aware employees and led by self-aware leaders are actually more profitable than companies who aren't. And so the benefits are pretty clear in a business setting. And then they also follow us up to our home life. We know that people who are self-aware are more satisfied in their romantic relationships. They're more satisfied with their friendships. They raise more mature, less narcissistic children, which I think for everybody in the 21st century is pretty helpful. So if you just look at all of those things in sum total, there aren't very many skills that if you dedicate yourself to improving, you're going to see that wide range of benefits. But the reason I call it the meta skill, and this is really important, is that particularly in the workplace, our self-awareness is going to set the upper limit for our success. In other words, you know, think about the best communicator you know, or the best leader you know, or the person who is just the most effective on a long-term basis. They're only as successful as they are self-aware. Because if we're not able to see ourselves clearly, we can't come from a place of values-based behavior. We can't question our assumptions. We can't identify how we're impacting others and change our approach if we need to. So I really see it as kind of the foundational skill, not just to be successful at work, but really to be someone who lives a meaningful, successful, enjoyable life.
Got it. And maybe just going, you know, starting from the basics, I think it'll be a good thing for us to define self-awareness, right? I'd love to hear from you. What are some of the common misconceptions you see around how people think about self-awareness?
You know, I've found over the years that self-awareness is a very similar term in some ways as the term communication. We could have 10 people talking about communication and all 10 of them could mean something different. So it's sort of inherently vague, not just in the meaning of it, but in the way people use it. And even more confusing, I've known people to talk about self-awareness in terms of the negative a lot more than the positive, right? You hear people say, well, that person just isn't very self-aware. But to paint the picture of a self-aware person, obviously, to your point, it's really important to start to understand how we can develop it. We've got to know what it is. And it took our, just to kind of backtrack a little bit, when I first started this research program, I had this really naive vision of what it would be. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I'll get a research team together. We might need to work over, you know, 6 months or 8 months, but I'm sure we'll learn a lot in a really short time period. And what we discovered really quickly was this was such a complex topic. And it took us almost a year to just define what self-awareness really was. And after we reviewed almost 1,000 empirical journal articles, we interviewed thousands of people around the world. We found people who dramatically increased their self-awareness. And here's what we came up with, just to save everybody the time. So self-awareness, it's pretty helpful, right? Self-awareness is made up of two types of self-knowledge. The first is something we named internal self-awareness, which is essentially knowing who we are on the inside. What do we value? What are we passionate about? What are our aspirations? What are the patterns of behavior that we exhibit across situations? But equally important is something called external self-awareness. And in a nutshell, what that means is knowing how other people see us. And what was fascinating, at least to me in our research, was that we found that those two types of self-knowledge, both are required for us to really be self-aware, but they're not related to each other, which I was kind of surprised by. I always thought, you know, if somebody kind of knows who they are from the inside, of course they would do the work and find out how they were seen on the outside and vice versa. But we discovered that they are, you sort of have to think about them as independent skill sets within the self-awareness area.
Very interesting. And maybe now's a good time to talk about your research methodology, right? And what really appealed to me was the notion of self-awareness unicorns. You talk about having spoken to hundreds and thousands of people and really whittling it down to a handful of people who you thought were unicorns in self-awareness. So I'm curious, just linking it back to what you just said about external and internal self-awareness, I'd be curious to understand a little bit more about who these unicorns are and what about them sets them apart from the pack.
Yeah, this is a really fun one. This was probably my favorite part of our whole research program. So we didn't set out to identify these people, and I'll define what a unicorn is in a second. What I originally thought was, all I have to do, you know, we developed and validated this very lengthy, comprehensive assessment of self-awareness. I thought all I have to do is go find a bunch of people who score high as rated by themselves and someone who knows them well, and then I'll crack the code of self-awareness. But what I discovered when we started to do that and we started to interview highly self-aware people is a lot of them, and I wouldn't venture a guess, but I'd say probably most, at least in our experience, had sort of always been like that. You know, you think about those people that are just naturally self-aware. It's just a way they're wired. And when we tried to figure out what they do to stay self-aware, they would literally say things like, you know, I've never really thought about that before. I don't know if I do anything consciously. And we were so frustrated. We were thinking, oh my gosh, how are we going to figure this out? And then it dawned on us that all we had to do was to replicate what I had seen with my coaching clients, right? Find people who didn't start out as self-aware, but who were able, you know, over the course of months and years of commitment and effort to learn to see themselves clearly. And so that's what we ended up doing. We searched the world. Basically, we used snowball sampling, which is you ask everyone you know to fill out the survey, and then they ask everyone they know. And it actually, we got all around the world in a very, very globally diverse sample. Mm-hmm. But what we found eventually were 50 people, 50, who not only were highly self-aware as rated by them and someone who knew them well, but they and the person who knew them well also basically established that they had improved their self-awareness. So there were checks and balances built into the system just because, you know, you sort of think about if I went up to 100 people and I said, hey, are you self-aware? Would you like to be a part of our study? I'm sure we'll talk about this later in the podcast, but most people are not very good judges of their self-awareness. Mm-hmm. So that was why, you know, we had to have all these checks and balances and it was very complicated. But once we found these 50 people, a couple of observations, there were no demographic patterns by gender, age, nationality, job type, industry. We had students. We had a Fortune 50 executive. We had stay-at-home parents. We had professionals, really just a broad swath of people. And what was so interesting to me about that is it showed us that almost anyone can improve their self-awareness if they learn some of the tips and tricks that the unicorns uncovered for us. And so it was just a really fun process. And by the way, the reason we called them unicorns is my research assistants were joking that like, oh, you want us to find self-aware people who didn't start out that way? Well, we might as well be looking for unicorns. So everybody thought that was so funny. And then, you know, when we did find them, we thought, you know, this is kind of the perfect term for these people. It's hard to imagine that they exist, but when we found them, there was just so much we learned.
Got it. And maybe just double-clicking on that, Tasha, could you talk to us about what set them apart? What is it that they did, both on the internal self-awareness and external self-awareness? which was different from the rest?
Oh gosh, we could be here for several days, but let me give you a couple of examples. So the first thing that we saw in common across all of our unicorns was it was actually a mindset. And it wasn't always a mindset that they had, you know, up until the point they decided to become more self-aware, but it was something that I named being braver but wiser. And so basically what that means is, you know, you think about life and its stresses and complexities and just the, you know, the weight sometimes that can put on all of us. It's very easy to go through your life with rose-colored glasses and to say, I'm fabulous. You know, unless anyone tells me I'm doing anything especially egregious, I'm doing really well at everything and I'm awesome. And it's not to say that we shouldn't have self-confidence, because that's actually a really important piece of the puzzle. But what all of our unicorns did at some point was, you know, whether it was precipitated by some kind of event in their life, you know, maybe they were thrown into a new role at work, or some of them were fired for reasons they didn't understand, or they had, you know, something really unexpected happen in their personal life. They made the decision that it was worth the time and energy, and sometimes the pains of self-discovery for them to go on that journey. And what I love about that for the rest of us is it shows us that anyone can make that decision. And it's definitely hard to make that decision every day. And I'm a pragmatist. I always say that if we can decide to be braver but wiser more than half the time, we're probably in really good shape. And by the way, our unicorns aren't perfect, magical human beings. They're flawed and imperfect, just like all of us are. So that was the first thing. The other thing I'd say is, and I'm sure we can talk about this more, but they had really well-defined daily practices to improve their self-awareness. So that doesn't mean that they spend ridiculous amounts of time developing their self-awareness. We actually found that in some ways they spend less time with more benefit if they use the right approach. But things like regularly soliciting feedback from people who want them to be successful and will tell them the truth. Things like reflecting at the end of every day, asking, we call them daily check-ins, what went well today? What didn't go so well today? And then how can I be smarter tomorrow? But I think, you know, just as a sort of final point of the broad brush of what made them different was they didn't get into a cycle where they were navel gazing just to navel gaze. It was very strategic and smart and purpose driven. And I think that's important for us to remember, because sometimes people see self-awareness as just this, you know, almost too daunting to even think about process, right? Where it's like, I've got to go into deep psychological excavation mode for several years. It really isn't like that. And that was what was so freeing to me about what the unicorns taught us, is it's really about those daily practices that foster incremental insight over time.
Got it. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. It's interesting to hear Tasha speak about how we can weave meditation into our daily life. I was speaking with Rich Fernandez, CEO of Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute, an initiative that was incubated in Google to help their high performers cope with the pressures of being in a rocket ship.
Well, what I would say is ritualize it and routinize it. So make it a ritual or a routine. So personally, for me, it's the first thing I do when I wake up. I literally get up from bed, splash some water on my face, and I go downstairs to my office, and then I sit in the morning. And this is early morning before the sun is up. I'm an early riser. And before my family is awake, before I check my email or open up, you know, the laptop or look on my phone or anything, it's the first thing I do. And then the second thing I do is I brush my teeth. So it's to that level of routinization. Right? It's to that level of ritualization for me. It's just the hygiene factor, I call it. So to the extent you could make the formal practice of meditation a hygiene factor, it will help make it a habit in your life. The other suggestion I have is something we offer in our curriculum, which is make it a set of integrated practices. When people think about meditation, they think about having to do exactly what I just said, which is set aside, you know, X block of time and, you know, sit in a certain way and close your eyes and protect this space for formal practice, but there's also a way to practice mindfulness and meditation in an integrated way. So for example, as you move through the course of your day, integrate it into your day. Between meetings, you know, if you need to walk to the restroom, make that a walking meditation. I'm actually serious about that, right? Become aware of your body as it moves through space between your office and the restroom. Become aware of your footfall. Become aware of, you know, the felt sense of your body. How are you feeling actually in that moment? Or take the opportunity to focus on breath, or this being in India, this podcast, you know, if you have a mantra that you're, you know, that you're familiar with or particularly like, use that. And I say mantra, and there's often a religious component to that, but here, what I'm referring to is really finding an object of your attention to train your attention upon it, whether it be mantra or breath or walking or sensation. You can really do this throughout the course of your day. I was driving to work today and I was focusing on my breath, not so much so that I wasn't able to drive, but when there was a red light, when I was stopped in traffic, in and out for three breaths, I noticed my breath. Next stoplight, same thing. Integrated practice is also a helpful one.
Back to what Tasha says, I think there are several opportunities for us to be mindful during the day without necessarily getting into deep psychological excavation mode. If this topic is of interest, do tune into my conversation with Rich Fernandez. And this specific segment would be in Nugget 41.04. I have a small request for your consideration. I guess you notice that there are no ads in this podcast, neither is there any paywall. You would appreciate that it does take quite a bit of work and effort to research for a conversation, have the interview, edit it, break it into nuggets, cross-reference it, and share it with you. I do pour a significant amount of time, thought, heart, and resources into this podcast. If you're deriving value from the podcast and are looking to demonstrate your gratitude, could I request you to consider paying it forward and contributing it towards a cause that I've been associated with for 3+ years? I work closely with an organization called Antarang Foundation, co-founded by Priya Agrawal. They work with thousands of young adults from challenging backgrounds and help them play to their unique potential by keeping them in education, giving them employability skills, guiding reflection, and connecting them to the world of opportunity. As part of a group of philanthropists, social venture partners, I work closely with Priya and her team, and I've seen her work from up close. Here's Priya speaking about Antarang Foundation.
In India, almost all of our children, close to 100% of our children are enrolled in school. But the problem really begins once these children get to the high school stage. Now, so if you look at the dropout rate and the pattern that's there in our country, it's a little alarming to see that close to one half of our children actually drop out even before they complete high school. And then what happens after that is almost like it's almost like going down a slippery slope, because just about 25% of them get into higher education, and a really tiny and almost insignificant percentage actually get into the organized sector employment with any hope of career progression. So this was the large gap that I could see after working with children and young adults through the two organizations that I headed prior to starting Antarang in 2013. So Antarang really works to bridge this gap. Antarang launches careers for disadvantaged young adults. We do this through two structured programs. We begin with an intensive career guidance program that runs in all the government schools in Mumbai, Pune, and Udaipur, and also in a few schools in Varanasi. And once the children are older, once they are adults, once they are 17 and a half or 18 years of age, then we train them in core employability skills and place them in careers of their choice.
I would really appreciate if you could help some of these young adults play to their potential. You could do this in two ways. You could contribute financially to Antarang Foundation, or if you're in India, specifically around Mumbai or some of the other areas where Antarang has operations, you could consider employing some of their alumni. Do email me at deepakj.p2p@transitioninsight.com. I repeat, it's deepakj.p2p P2P at TranSition.com, and I will connect you with the right person to give you further details. Thank you in advance. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Tasha Urich. And now shifting the focus to, let's say, the mere mortals, the non-unicorns, if you will.
Right. The rest of us, including me.
and me, if I could throw myself in. You talk about, leaders being self-delusional rather than self-aware. And you, in the book Insight, you talk about three things, right? Knowledge, emotion, and behavioral blindness. Given the work I do, I see this as an epidemic, if you will, right? I'm really curious about your research here around why is it so? Why is it that so many people are self-delusional rather than self-aware?
Oh, that's a big question. So there are really two main contributors, at least according to our research. Some of them come from inside of us with just the way humans are built. And then the other cause comes from our environment. So just to take the first one, there's so much to this, but essentially humans are built to see ourselves with rose-colored glasses. It's sort of like, if you think about it, it's like eating sugar. You know, it feels great, but in the long term, it's not good for us. And not eating sugar takes a lot of discipline, and it takes that daily commitment that we were talking about. And so, you know, the inclination of most people on a day-to-day basis is focus on the problems, focus on the emergency of the day. And then in addition to that, the way we're wired, we're just not aware of so many of our unconscious thoughts and feelings, and even a lot of our behaviors. So we're sort of born with a blindfold on. And if you think about it, if that's our default state, it's no wonder that so many people have so much room to improve their self-awareness. The other piece of that I think is important to mention is 95% of people believe that they're self-aware, and only about 10 to 15% of people actually are. And of course, that vastly oversimplifies it, but just to give you kind of the high level. And so this thought of, well, I'm self-aware, I don't really need to work on my self-awareness is kind of the default state. But then if we look externally and we look at, this has been found in almost every culture around the world, we are living in a world where we are more and more focused on ourselves while at the same time seeing ourselves less and less clearly. And you look at things like social media and reality TV and the self-esteem movement, which it turns out self-esteem actually doesn't help us be more successful. All of those things are creating an environment where we're being tempted to become more self-absorbed and less self-aware. So, you know, if you take a step back from all of that, it's so easy to, you know, think about that terrible, unself-aware boss that we work for example, and say, well, that person's just a bad person. They obviously don't want to be better. It really is not that simple in most cases, in my experience, is that lack of awareness isn't an indictment of who we are as people. It really is just something we have to consciously decide to push past. And again, that's why our unicorns were so inspiring.
Got it. And coming back to internal self-awareness, Tasha, you talk about the sort of the perils of introspection, right? You talk about the four follies of introspection. But I think what really caught my attention was the nuance that you bring out and how we ask the right question, the why question versus the what question, and the boundary between introspection and rumination. So could you talk to the listeners about the insight here? What are the challenges in us introspecting our way for self-awareness? And secondly, how do we be productive in the way we conduct the inquiry?
We had so many surprises in our research, situations where we would collect data and it would literally say the opposite of what I predicted we would see. And one of the earliest surprises in our whole program was what I thought was a really simple investigation. So we surveyed about 300 people and we ask them, how much time do you spend introspecting? In other words, kind of pondering the deeper meaning behind our thoughts and our feelings and our motives. And then we surveyed them on things like, are you stressed? Are you depressed? Are you anxious? Are you happy? Do you like your job? Are you happy with your relationships? Do you feel in control of your life? And naturally, because self-awareness is good, I knew that we would find that the more people introspected, the better off they'd be. And that was the opposite of what our data showed. So we found that people who self-reflected often were more anxious, more stressed, more depressed, less satisfied with their jobs and their relationships. They were even less in control of their lives. And we're just sitting there going, oh my gosh, maybe self-awareness is bad, right? Maybe delusion is actually what we want to be fostering, because this doesn't seem like it makes sense. And as we started to dig into some of the data, we started to discover that thankfully, it's not that introspection in and of itself is bad. It's just that the way most of us introspect is completely wrong. And the best way to illustrate this, you know, again, without having 2 hours to delve into it, is to think about probably what the most common introspective question is for most people, which is the question, why? So we might be trying to understand why we're in a bad mood. You know, you could say, why am I so upset after that conversation with my coworker? Or we might be trying to understand a bad outcome. You know, like, why didn't I get that promotion? Or we might be even trying to understand why we believe what we believe. You know, why do I want that promotion? But as it turns out, those questions, not only do they lead us away from true insight about ourselves, they give us a false sense of confidence about our knowledge. So for example, Sigmund Freud was wrong. He believed in his work that people could access their unconscious, right? So like, really, why am I upset? If I just excavate, if I just think long and hard and ask that why question, I can find the answer. But what research has shown for, you know, decades actually, is that no matter how hard we try, we can't access so many of those things. It's what I mentioned earlier about the behavior and emotion and knowledge blindness. Mm-hmm. So what happens is we find an answer that feels true, even if it's wrong. So that's an example of where it can lead us away from the truth rather than towards it. Another reason why is a really dangerous question, introspectively, is it has been shown over and over and over to depress us. You know, you think about it, like, why didn't I get that promotion? If you're not careful, you can start asking questions where the answers are, well, because I'm just a fundamentally bad person and who would want to promote me? And you can kind of get stuck in, I call it the rabbit hole of rumination. And so what we wanted to do in our study was understand, okay, if why is the wrong question, what is the right question? You know, what are these unicorns doing differently than the rest of us? And it took us a little while to find this pattern, but we discovered that when unicorns introspected, they almost never asked why questions. They asked what questions. And at first I thought like, oh, that's just a weird sort of fluke or a weird nuance. But as we started to look into it, it started to make a huge amount of sense. So one example would be, you know, going back to the question, why didn't I get that promotion? Mm-hmm. Unicorns, if they were in that situation, wouldn't ask themselves that question. Here's some questions they might have asked instead. What did I learn that can help me be better positioned in the future? Or what can I do to close the gap between, you know, where I thought I was and where I need to be? Or what support can I enlist from the people around me to help me, you know, achieve this goal the next time I set it? Or, you know, going back to why am I so upset about that conversation with my coworker? They might instead ask, well, what part of that situation did I own? Or what can I do differently in the future to avoid that kind of conversation with that person? And so what we found was asking what instead of why really helps us avoid so many of the pitfalls of introspection, where we, you know, we're excavating for the truth that we're never going to find, and we're focusing on our problems and feeling victimized and disempowered. So I think what I loved about that is it's a really tangible tool that I think we can take away. It seems subtle, but the difference is just huge. And I'm speaking from personal experience as I've started to use that as well.
Got it. And
In terms of internal self-awareness, you also talk about the distinction between mindfulness and meditation. And you say that meditation does not necessarily lead to mindfulness. What's the insight here, and how does one get to non-meditative mindfulness, if there's a term like that?
Sure. Yeah, and you're bringing up a really important issue. I would slightly tweak that to say meditation isn't the only way we can be mindful, because there's so many of us who are type A people, or we're so busy we can't imagine finding 20 minutes to sit in silence. And meditation is associated, obviously, with mindfulness, and that link has been really clearly established. It's also linked to self-awareness. So people who meditate tend to be more self-aware as a whole. But the question I wanted to answer is, what about the people who don't meditate? Is there still some way that we can be mindful, in spite of maybe not practicing that? And I go back and forth with meditation. Sometimes I get on a really good streak, and sometimes I fall off the wagon. But what we discovered were several non-meditative mindfulness tools. And the way to think about these that made it click for me is what does it really mean to be mindful? And, there's a lot of nuance to this, but at a high level, it means noticing what's happening in ourselves and our environment without judgment. And what's really important is you're noticing new things. Again, you're not getting trapped in rumination. You're not going down the spiral of introspections. You're just seeing what is. So here's one example of a non-meditative mindfulness tool that we saw in our unicorns. It's called comparing and contrasting. So basically what you do is, if you're experiencing a positive or negative state, instead of getting down that introspective rabbit hole, here's an example of what you could do. So let's say you get home from work one day and you're just in a terrible mood. Instead of saying, why am I in such a terrible mood? You could say, when are the other times that I've felt this way in my recent memory, right? So you might think, oh gosh, I remember feeling this way last week, and I remember feeling this way a couple of months ago. And then you ask yourself, what do those things have in common? So, I tell a story in my book about how I felt terrible after coming home from work for enough days in a row that I realized that was my pattern. Is about 2 years after I started any job, I would just get sort of, I would feel disempowered, and I wouldn't feel like I was doing good work or I was satisfied with it. And that led me to the discovery, as I looked at all those similarities, that maybe I'm not built to work in a corporation or for someone else. But by not getting too sucked into that feeling and just noticing that state as it was related to things I could remember in the past, it led to a really big insight. So that's just one example of the tools, but I think it's a powerful one.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. The other habit that I've seen several leaders use to become more mindful is some sort of journaling. This is not just business CEOs, but leaders from other disciplines. In this podcast, I spoke to Dr. Ramachandra Guha, a celebrated historian who spent several decades studying Gandhiji. He spoke at length about how Gandhiji would keep a diary where he would reflect and process all the complexity around him and stay mindful of what was going on. Another guest on the podcast was Vinay Sitapati, another historian who's written the book Half Lion. In the book, he profiles the journey of Narasimha Rao, arguably one of the most influential prime ministers India has seen. More specifically, he speaks about how Narasimha Rao managed to get so much done despite several constraints around him, and he specifically referred to his practice of keeping a diary.
And Narasimha Rao's ability to be introspective, to be inward, helped him sift the day into what, or to put it in statistical terms, to be able to sift the signal from the noise. So I think that's the first thing that introspection taught him, that, one is it taught him don't trust anyone except your diary, which is a pretty good skill in politics. Second is that you should be able to sift the signal from the noise. Who are the people you met every day? How many people are being honest? How many people are lying? To give you just one example, one of the diary entries which I have in the book is from 22nd May 1991. This is the day after Rajiv Gandhi has been killed near Chennai. And Narasimha Rao, who until then had been basically eased out of the Congress and was about to become a monk in a monastery called Kottralam in Tamil Nadu and was closing his bank accounts, is suddenly realizing that by virtue of being the least ambitious man in the party, he's primed to be Prime Minister of India, right? And the diary shows, 22nd May, he's back in Delhi. He's in 10 Janpath, where Sonia Gandhi and Rajiv used to live. And, pieces of Rajiv Gandhi's body, they're just pieces, they're not the full body, are kept there. And all the congressmen are around the body pretending to cry, some of them actually crying, while actually trying to maneuver to see who would succeed him. And he has this wonderful passage about how Pranab Mukherjee, who was in the boondocks then, but would later recover to become President of India, wheedles up to him and says, "We think you should become Prime Minister, Congress President," which is the proxy for Prime Minister of India. And Narasimha Rao immediately says, "I immediately told him that, that I'm not the right person," right? Knowing full well the kind of person he is. "I also gave him the name of N.D. Tiwari for Prime Minister of India, knowing that he was even less likely a candidate than I am," right? And I think the introspection and the diary allows him to do that. It allows him to reflect over the day. Otherwise, think of it. Somebody else come, Pranab Mukherjee came up to me and says, "Maybe you should be Prime Minister of India." I wouldn't stop to ask what's his angle, right? So I think the introspection gave him that ability. I think the third thing introspection gave him was to take the long view. Often we're so caught up in the moment that we're unable to, to see short-term benefit from long-term, long-term costs. We're unable to separate that, right? For example, Narasimha Rao was frequently sidelined from the party, frequently. He never complained. He never protested against Indira Gandhi. He never protested against Rajiv Gandhi. And very soon he would be back. Whereas people like Sharad Pawar, right, Arjun Singh, right, or N.D. Tiwari, at the first sign that they were out of favor in the Nehru-Gandhi court, would either form a separate party or sulk or protest. And their careers would end, instead of just kind of, taking it and, hoping that your luck changes, which happened to Narasimha Rao. Now look, not everybody's luck changes, right? But I think Narasimha Rao's ability to take the long view and not make silly short-term beneficial decisions also contributed to the kind of career he had.
I guess the key point is that there are many paths to being mindful than just meditation. It's worth keeping an open mind and not giving up if meditation is not up your alley. Some people speak about reflecting about some of the deeper issues when they're running or swimming. I guess we all need to find our own mechanism that works for us, but the key is to create some space for us to reflect, whether it's meditation or otherwise. If this topic is of interest, do refer to Nugget 30.03 with Vinay Sitapati at playtopotential.com or Nugget 41.05 with Rich Fernandez. You could also listen to the Nuggets at the playlist titled Mindfulness in the curated playlist section at playtopotential.com. Building from the earlier segment, here's the founder of Antarang Foundation, Priya Agarwal, speaking about the why behind Antarang Foundation and providing some granularity around the kind of work they do there.
Antarang envisions a world where every young adult is passionately, productively, and positively engaged in a career of their choice. And this career and choice, right, has to be the prerogative of every young adult, irrespective of their socioeconomic status. What happens today is that, the concept of careers and career progression becomes really the, sole prerogative of the privilege, and that is what we're trying to break. If you look at our student population, up until now, we've been in existence for about 6.5 years, and we've worked with over 55,000 young adults. If you look at our students, they are podcast editors, they are filmmakers, they are fitness instructors, they are bankers, they are educators, they're beauticians, they're therapists. So it's really across the board. And it's actually quite simple, right? If more and more people get to know about the potential of these young adults, it's so easy to link them to careers of their choice. Today, getting good quality talent, talent that has the right attitude, is really the biggest, is really the biggest issue today. In fact, most employers have been telling us, don't worry about the technical training. That's something that we can do. If you're able to give us young adults with the right attitude, we will go ahead and train them.
I'm a firm believer that intrinsic potential is uniformly distributed. But unfortunately, the world of opportunity is not. do email me at deepakj.p2p@transitioninsight.com if you wish to contribute to make a difference to some of these young adults. I repeat, my email ID is deepakj.p2p@transitioninsight.com. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Tasha Urich. Got it. And shifting the attention to external self-awareness, right? While gathering external feedback, you refer to the metaphor of a prism versus a mirror to describe the richness of feedback that one could often get. What's the key insight here? And given that, for example, 360 is a phrase that gets thrown around in corporate circles, right? What are the common pitfalls you see in the way people gather external feedback?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I would even say, even before talking about external feedback, it's important to paint the context of where external feedback fits in with our self-perceptions. Because here's something I notice, you know, when I'm speaking, and I see this all over the world, whenever I ask a group of leaders, for example, whose opinion of you matters more, yours or your employees? And they all smile proudly and shout out, "My employees," right? Because they've read all those articles about 360s. But what the research on this, right? Like they feel, you know, and it's sort of easy to oversimplify that. But what the research on this has shown really conclusively, in my opinion, is that both types of data are hugely important. And what's even more critical is they represent different types of information about ourselves. So for example, even if they conflict, they're both valid. And that's part of what we saw with our unicorns is there's a quote by F. Scott Fitzgerald that's something like, the definition of true intelligence is to be able to hold two opposing viewpoints in our minds and still retain the ability to function. Our unicorns were able to get feedback and say, you know, this is really different than the way I see myself. And that's okay. That doesn't mean I'm wrong and they're right or vice versa. It just means that there are different ways of seeing me and those different ways are valid. And that's where it comes to the prism metaphor. So most people think about self-awareness as something, you know, the simple metaphor would be, I look in the mirror, I see my reflection, and that is who I am. But it's a lot more complicated. And everyone probably remembers from science class when they were young that when you shine a white light through a prism on one end, on the other end, it comes out as a beautiful rainbow. And the way I like to think about self-awareness is, you know, it's every single reflection or every single light that goes through, you get a richer, fuller picture of who you are. So every data point that you get, whether it's your own, whether it's your spouse, whether it's your coworkers, your employees, your boss, each of those are valid and helpful, right? It doesn't mean that we have to listen to every single piece of feedback we get. We can go into that in a second too. But what it does mean is that I think it's just that open curiosity that is so hugely important. So I think that's probably the biggest pitfall, to go back to your question, is oversimplifying the different roles that feedback plays relative to our own self-perceptions.
The other piece I wanted to discuss with you, Tasha, was the benefit of working with somebody, whether it's decoding internal self-awareness or external self-awareness. Do you have a view on that? You know, as a coach, there's sort of a vested interest in asking this question, but even otherwise, what's the benefit you see a third party or another individual brings in bringing richness of data in improving self-awareness?
Absolutely. So I learned this from my good friend, Marshall Goldsmith. And the bottom line is that other people have this amazing and annoying way of seeing us far more clearly sometimes than we can see ourselves. And, you know, you sort of think about the leader who goes in every day and really feels like they're doing a great job for their employees. And then, you know, I go and I interview their employees and they say, oh my gosh, working for this person is the worst thing I've ever done. I've had coaching clients where I've, you know, and basically I go in when I'm working with a CEO or with someone else as their coach, I interview as many people as I can that work with them. So sometimes it's up to 25 people. I talk to their employees. employees, their board members, their colleagues, their family, even their spouse. So I see this time and time again, where you're getting very similar themes across people. And there's a lot of power in that. And the reason is, it doesn't necessarily mean they're right or they're wrong, but it's the prevailing perception. And knowledge is power when it comes to that type of feedback. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to change. It doesn't mean that you will want to change, but having that data is what allows you to make an informed and empowered decision. And that's where I see my coaching clients really making the most dramatic transformations, is when they decide to listen to that feedback and to respond to it and to circle back with the people that gave that feedback and make sure they're making improvements.
And maybe persisting with this, Tasha, could you share a little bit of insight around how one gathers this data? As a coach, you said you speak to up to 25 people across different realms of life. Is there any nuance around, you know, how you do it and what some of the common pitfalls are in the way people go about collecting this data?
Yeah, so there, I customize it depending on the client. So the four questions I ask are, number one, what is this person doing on a daily basis that's contributing to their success as a leader? Number two, what does this person do that is detracting from their success? Number three, what situations bring out the best in this person? And number four, what situations bring out the worst in this person? And I actually learned those last two questions from Marshall Goldsmith, who I'm sure most of your listeners know his work. He's considered the number one leadership thinker and coach in the world. And there are a lot of nuances that come out of those second two questions. And, you know, you sort of think about it where if you're trying to get a snapshot from someone in 30 minutes, if you can ask similar questions, slightly different ways, you're going to pick up on nuances to their behavior. And usually it's those nuances, right? Those very small daily actions that that person is, you know, demonstrating that are what are so helpful. And that's where, when it comes to traditional quantitative 360s, right, where you say, oh, this person is a 3 out of 5 on teamwork. The challenge with those, they can be helpful, and I'm not discounting their value. But sometimes you say, well, 3 out of 5 on teamwork, what am I doing exactly that's making people rate me that way? And you can sort of try to read between the lines of your open-ended comments. But for me, what I can do as a coach is, you know, I ask those four questions or some kind of variation of them, and then I can start testing hypotheses, right? Mm. I can see if multiple people are bringing up the same behavior or even the same situation. And that gives me the ability not just to say you're a 3 out of 5 on teamwork, but here are some nuances. You know, here's what you're doing really well. Here is what is not maybe coming across in the way you want it to. Here are several specific examples. Again, protecting confidentiality, which is probably the number one most important thing, in my opinion. But if 5 people bring something up, it's obviously something that everybody is seeing. Sure. And so you've got to balance that. And obviously, whenever I'm writing up my reports, I don't do very, very, very specific excerpts from the interviews for that reason. But again, going back to what I said earlier, people tend to start saying almost the exact same thing after a point. You know, sometimes there's a variation, sure, depending on the stakeholder group. But I would say those are just a couple of initial thoughts.
Got it. And is there a way or is there a nuance to the way people think about developing awareness when they're in a career transition versus when they're in a role? Because in a transition, you're often grappling with more open-ended problems in terms of what next and which pathway do I take, versus in a role, it's the question is often, how do I get better at what I do? So have you observed a sort of a thematic difference across the two?
I think that when you're in a career transition, to your excellent point, it allows you to evaluate even deeper aspects of who you are. And, you know, I think it's pretty normal on a day-to-day basis for people to look at their patterns of behavior or the impact they're having on the people around them. But there are some kind of deeper, more fundamental questions that we should all answer. And that I think if we're in a career transition, it gives us an excellent excuse to investigate things like values. You know, what are the principles that I want to live my life by? The reason that's important is if you are, you know, looking for work and you interview with a company that doesn't share those values, or a job that doesn't allow you to bring those values with you every day, that's good information to have. And by that same token, we want to know, what are our passions? You know, what are those things that really make us want to leap out of bed in the morning, and how can we design our life to do them? Another is aspirations. What do we want to not just accomplish in our life and our work, but what do we want this experience called life to be for ourselves? And so I think that it's certainly overwhelming, and it requires more work and more effort and more focused, thought, but it's such a great way to reset. And going back to our unicorns, so many of them gave examples of transition. There's different types of, I call them alarm clock events, right? Things that kind of wake us up to who we really are, and new roles or rules. You know, we're in a new job, or we're in a new environment, or we come to a fork in the road in our work or in our life. They're just such ripe opportunities for us to see ourselves more clearly.
Got it. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. It was interesting to hear Tasha use the term alarm clock events to describe points in time that shake people's life. For me, it was my father in India being diagnosed with stage 4 cancer when I was working with McKinsey in New Jersey in the US. This was sometime in 2008, more than a decade ago. And that really changed a lot of things for me. Number one, it gave me a sense of the end game of life, as I got to spend the last 6 months of my father's life very close to him. I got a sense of what really mattered in the end. And second, till then I was possibly leading a skills-based life, asking myself, where can I deploy my problem-solving skills and my numeric capabilities, and consulting felt like the right logical canvas. This period was the first time I started reflecting on what gave me energy, and I felt I had to do something on the people side of things, however cliched that sounds. So that took me to Egon Zehnder, the executive search firm, where I worked for about 6 years, helping clients recruit CEOs, CXOs, and board members. Further reflection during the journey in search led me to believe that I got my energy from helping people and not so much from judging them. And I wanted to have fewer, deeper conversations with people around me. That has taken me to do what I do now, which is a combination of leadership and transition advisory, and this podcast that you're listening to. Both pursuits are about having deep, reflective, purposeful conversations with people. Without the alarm clock event, I'm not sure if I would have embarked on this path of reflection. But having been through all this, I realize that we don't have to wait for an alarm clock event to do this. I realize that in the workplace, we often get feedback around how we can do better in the job we are in. But in transition or in life, we're actually asking a different question. What is the canvas or the series of canvases where I can flourish? Or how can I design my life that makes sense for me? Just like Tasha says that internal and external self-awareness are not highly correlated, I feel that there's not much overlap between the data you need to advance in a job and the data you need to transition thoughtfully. The two sets of data are a bit orthogonal, if you know what I mean. Of course, this is more of an anecdotal view and not a research-backed view. At least, not yet. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Tasha Urich. And coming to receiving feedback, Tasha, you talk about three types of people, right? Lost cause, aware, don't care, and nudgeable. And I love the way I used to work in McKinsey. So whenever anyone breaks it down to three things, it's instinctively appealing. How do you look out for these types? And in what ways do we approach our feedback differently towards each of these segments?
So this might not be the answer you're looking for, but it's something I feel very passionate about. At some point in almost every keynote I give, someone will raise their hand and ask that question. And I think at the heart of that question is usually something to the effect of, how do I make other people more self-aware, right? And you brought up the different types of unself-aware people. And I'll just sort of briefly define what those are and then come back to my original point. So one are lost causes. These are the people who, despite the amount of feedback they get, they could hear the same thing from 100% of the people they work with and live with, and they are still convinced that they're close to perfection. These are not people that anyone is ever going to change. There's also the aware don't care. These are people who know exactly what a jerk they're being and will continue to do it anyway because they believe, mistakenly, that that's helping them achieve something they want, right? Success or some twisted version of success in their mind. The third, which is most people, is something that I named nudgeable, right? People who are able to be nudged. And if you're the right type of person, if you have the right kind of relationship, if you use the right kind of approach, you can very often help these people see themselves more clearly. This goes back to what we were discussing earlier, where, you know, most unself-aware people are not bad people. They just don't know what they don't know. But in spite of all of that, it's so common for us to focus our attention, our self-awareness attention on all the people around us, right? Gosh, I wish my spouse could be more self-aware, or my coworker, or my client. But it usually is a risky endeavor. If we take it on ourselves to make someone more self-aware, we may or may not be successful, and there is often an inherent risk. So the first thing I tell people is think really carefully about whether you are willing to accept the worst case scenario of trying to help that person. And, you know, there's a lot of nuances to that depending on the relationship we have with them, the power dynamic we have, I wouldn't even make up a percentage. I would say a large amount of the time, channeling that energy into our own journey is a better use of our energy and attention. That doesn't mean that we don't have to live with these unself-aware people. So one of the things that our unicorns taught us was focusing on our own reactions and perceptions of their behavior is something we have a lot more control over than the behavior itself. So there's one tool I talk about in my book. I call it the laugh track. And this is actually a mindfulness reframing technique. I developed it when I was working for this very unself-aware, very unintentionally nasty boss. And every time he would say something nasty, instead of getting wrapped up in feeling hurt or offended or sad, I would imagine that we were on a television show with a canned laugh track. And the laugh track would come on every time he said something horrible. And what I noticed was it allowed me to snap out of the moment and out of the instinctive reaction I had and see him a little bit differently. You know, sometimes I would think about it later and I would say, actually, with the laugh track behind it, that was kind of funny. And so what I would encourage people to do, instead of diving head on to that, I'm going to give this unaware person feedback, is to, again, be very careful about making that strategic decision if you want to talk to them or not. And then no matter what, you can always focus on your own perception of their behavior and try to limit the amount of time you spend with them if that's at all possible.
That's fascinating. I'm reminded of the Wimbledon finals recently between Novak Djokovic and Roger Federer. And, Novak had the whole crowd in Wimbledon rooting for Federer. And when somebody asked him, how did you really manage to keep your calm and keep your motivation levels when everybody was rooting for Roger Federer? He said something interesting. He said, each time somebody said, go Roger, I sort of transmutated it in my head and made it sound as go Novak for myself.
I love it.
So it sounds a bit like the laugh track point you just made. But that's fascinating, Tasha. Just wrapping up, the one thing I wanted to talk to you about, which really caught my attention, was the notion of catch-22 of self-awareness. And in the book, you say that people who need it the most are usually the least likely to know that they need it. So I think in a way, just so that I ensure that I frame it right, not that I frame it as a external problem, but when I throw myself in that mix, how does one watch out for not falling in this trap? What are the watch outs? So that we don't get caught in that catch-22.
I'm going to make this really simple for all of us. And this is a hard won and fought lesson for me personally. It's to make the decision to gently stop assuming that we are self-aware. And there is an inherent paradox both to unawareness and awareness, right? The unaware people usually don't know they're unaware. The other side of that paradox is the most self-aware people never get overly confident about their level of self-awareness. And they don't do it in a way that is self-deprecating or in a way that erodes their confidence. They do it in a way that is open and curious. There was one unicorn that we spoke to. His name was Kelsey, and he's a middle school science teacher, just a so inspiring, amazing young man. And he likens the quest of self-awareness to exploring space. And what he said was, you know, what I love about it is no matter how much we know, there is always so much that we have yet to learn. And, you know, just speaking personally, this research program has knocked me off of my own self-awareness pedestal. You know, I thought when I started out, I'm pretty self-aware. I'm probably going to discover that. And I discovered that I am not nearly as self-aware as I thought I was. But what I've been able to do, learning from our unicorns and our research subjects, is to reframe that. It's to say, you know, I am going to take the default mindset that I don't know myself as well as I think I do. And I'm going to take every piece of data that comes my way as data, as exactly that, right? Oh, this is really interesting. I wonder what this is about. And I think if we can do that, in some ways, that's half the battle. If we can make that decision that no matter how much I think I know about myself, there's always more to know, that puts us far and away beyond most people.
Got it. And just wrapping up, Tasha, which element of self-awareness are you curious about, given your work and given your continued interest in this space? What element of self-awareness are you, let's say, going deeper in or researching in your journey?
The thing that is fascinating me right now are cultural differences in self-awareness. And funny story, I was doing a talk. I was somewhere in Canada. I actually don't remember the city. And someone came up to me who worked for a large consulting company. And she said, hey, if you ever want a sample of, you know, leaders in 20 countries, give me a call. And I was so excited. This was like the holy grail. And then I lost her business card. And so we've been trying to find another sample for a little while. But to me, I think that is the next frontier. If you look at just sort of cultural differences and how self-awareness overlays onto that, anecdotally, I think there's a lot to it. And I'm hopefully excited to bite that off as our next piece.
Lovely. Tasha, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your insights and for making the time for the podcast.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for the great questions.
Thank you. I hope you found this conversation purposeful. A couple of things struck me in this conversation. First is the point that Tasha makes about the rabbit hole of rumination. There is indeed a downside to over-introspection. A lot of the people that come to work with me actually do so because they've hit a point of analysis paralysis with a reflection. I like the point Tasha makes about the kind of questions we need to ask ourselves as we introspect. She talks about the usefulness of the what versus the why questions. I was recently listening to an interview of Jim Collins on the Tim Ferriss show. Jim is considered one of the leading thinkers in the field of management of our times. He's the author of books like Good to Great, Built to Last, and Great by Choice. His books have sold more than 10 million copies worldwide. Tim Ferriss asked him about how he spent his day, and one of the things he said really struck me. He said that every day as he wraps up a day, he would just write down the three or four things he got done that day. He says that he would also give himself a score between -2 and +2 on just how he felt about the day. Just a gut feel. +2 is when you have a great day, -2 is when you have a lousy day, and the rest is in between. Jim goes on to say that he does this for a while, and then every 3 months or so, he takes a step back and looks at what's going on. He looks at all the +2 days and sees what's common to all these days. He looks at all the -2s and sees what's in the pattern. I guess the key insight for me, just linking it back to what Tasha says, is that when we're too close to a situation, it's hard for us to analyze what's going on. It's helpful to collect adequate data, the what questions, as Tasha says, for a period of time before we get to the why question for us to have a meaningful outcome, or a meaningful insight rather. The second piece was a point she makes about going on a self-awareness journey as exploring space. The metaphor of space is a great one. I guess building self-awareness is a never-ending journey and not something where you get complete mastery. As somebody who learns the guitar, I would possibly liken this to music. The more you learn, the more you realize there is to learn as you build your capability.
you start appreciating nuances that you didn't even know existed when you started out on the journey. I personally learned a lot from this conversation. I hope you found it purposeful too. Finally, just a few comments as we wrap up the show. If you find the content of value, please rate the show and write a review on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you consume the content. And if you want to share your gratitude for the value you're deriving from the podcast, do consider contributing to Antarang Foundation. There are millions of young adults who are playing the game of life with a big handicap. Your contribution will make a big difference in helping some of them play to their unique potential. You could mail me at deepakj.p2p@transitioninsight.com. That's deepakj.p2p@transitioninsight.com. And I could connect you to the right resource at Antarang Foundation. The next podcast conversation is with Alan Eagle, the co-author of the book Trillion Dollar Coach, a book that describes the ways of Bill Campbell, who coached the who's who of Silicon Valley, including Steve Jobs, the leadership team at Google, and several other CEOs and founders. To know more about the leadership and transition advisory work I do, please visit the About section at playtopotential.com. I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. Bye now.